And hello, people of the internet. How's it going today? How you doing? I'm Billy Bones, and this is A Walk Through the Mind, a moment where we can sit down, hang out, chit-chat, discuss a handful of ideas that have been bouncing around inside my head, and see if we can't go out and get the conversation started with friends, family, the people we meet on the street, or maybe we just get those gears turning within our own heads and see where it takes us. So I've been doing a little bit of learning, per the usual. This time, the path has taken me in the transistor, the integrated circuit way of things, best highlighted by Moore's Law, not Murphy's Law. Murphy's Law is when something can go wrong, it will go wrong. Stay away, Murphy. Go over yonder. But Moore's Law, it's the observation that the number of transistors on an integrated circuit will double about every 2 years. This was theorized, come to be a theory, a little bit later turned into more or less the law, kind of like the law of gravity. But it theorized in the mid-60s when transistors were all the rage. But I want to kind of take a step back before we even discovered transistors, before tubes. There was a individual named Herman Hollerith, an American, invented a tabulating machine called the Hollerith machine. And think of this thing like a giant Scantron machine, except it was invented in the 1800s. I don't know if we had number two pencils back then. Scantrons work by reading the electrical filaments of the graphite or whatever the pencil lead is of a number two pencil, not your mechanical pencil. Those don't have the right electrical properties, so they don't read. Do we still have this problem nowadays in school? But the Hollerith machine, you would take a specific style of cardstock. Had to be special cardstock, couldn't be your regular old papyrus from Egypt, nice and thin. No, it had to be sturdy cardstock, so that way it could handle the punches of all of the different characteristics that you wanted to classify and clarify. So that way, afterwards, it would be the original machine. Had a little press, a little hand press, and all of the potential pins, potential holes would have a pin location. So as you press down this press, the pins would come down, and if there was a hole, it would create an electrical current. It would advance one of the little dials to tell you that that number had been increased by however many. And then a separate box would open up, and you could sort these pieces of card into each of all these different things, and you could have your organization. This came to fruition for the 1890 census, United States census. Saved the United States about $3 million, about a third of their budget. And we were off to the races to kind of condense everything. IBM took the machine and took the company due to the Mr. Hollerith's inability to create a business. He was out there just leasing his product instead of turning it into something more. IBM acquired it, and the race to consolidate data was on. Now, this ability to, more or less in a heartbeat, in the grand scheme of things, from before the time of all this fancy electricity, everybody was doing things by hand. They're doing calculations in their head and with abacuses. And then one person would have to transcribe and pass it along and then move it left and right, put it in one folder or another. Bill, why'd you missort this? Don't know. But now all of this was done, again, in a blink of an eye. So much quicker than anything people had would have thought. And again, with the Hollerith machine and more advanced technology and machining abilities, the education to understand how materials are built and inlaid, like a steel skillet isn't just steel. It's got chromium and nickel and all sorts of other fancy things in there, making things stronger and more durable. Alloys being a big thing. But this giant clunky contraption taking up the space of little bit more than two upright pianos, but it was speed. It was faster than what it took for the same number of people it would have taken, each with their own drafting desk, each with their own filing cabinet, each with their own little lamp. And then we fast forward just a little bit to tubes, vacuum tubes, very specially made item. Watched a little video of someone recreating the process, or what I believe to be the process, of hand-making tubes. Make them in batches, so you make a whole bunch of them, but still a very specific, laborious process. Melting and shaping all of the glass, hand-soldering all of the little bits and pieces together, and then all of these giant things in what we look at today as computers. Giant, giant tubes. Putting off heat. You had to let them warm up because of how much electricity had to flow through. And you're using giant wires. We don't have 3D printers back in the 1920s, 1930s, 1940s. So it takes time, it takes energy to get all this up and running and moving. And then after World War II, transistors were starting to become invented, discovered. Transistors are layers of materials that help control the flow of electrons that work like relays, switching power on and off to help with computations and calculations. But even still, back in the day, they were huge. I think of just even my time frame of showing up to bare minimum understandings of computers in the late 90s. Those giant things were still huge compared to what we carry around in our pockets nowadays. But these tubes and these wires, so much heat, so minimal of what we were able to store and understand. And then the microprocessor comes in, more advanced transistor chip work, being able to put so many little transistors onto one little tiny section. Moore's Law kicking in. They were taking projectors and photosensitive chemicals back in the day before digital cameras. You had film. You had to go get your film processed, and they throw it in a wash of chemicals. And those same chemicals worked for printing the circuits, the integrated circuits, onto these chipboards, so you could layer the specific chemicals and things you needed to make sure that the electrons were going to flow in the correct way. And all of this was being invented and created in Silicon Valley. A lot of American companies out there to hone and help create these processes. Lenses, the Kodak company being huge, DARPA, helped fund a lot of things, but people realized that the consumer market had a lot more expendable income. And layering these chemicals turned out to be a little bit more difficult of a process than just lining up tubes, as one would kind of think. All the tubes being soldered. There's a video, quite the fair amount of show notes today, but there's a video in there of the guy who has a 4-bit piece of memory, RAM, random access memory. And for one of the bits of RAM, and granted he's recreating it with tubes, but it took him 6 hours just to fill up one board for one bit of RAM. So you start thinking about how many bits of RAM. Do we even know how many bits of RAM our phones have? 256 gigabytes. Bytes is, what is there, eight bits and one byte. 1,024 bytes in a megabyte or kilobyte. That's a kilobyte. 1024 kilobytes into a megabyte, 1024 megabytes in a gigabyte. Lots of bits. Lots and lots of bits. But again, this process has to be specific. All of these chemicals and metals, all of these alloys, very finicky. And now they had to get laid out. The book I'm reading, Chip War, by Chris Miller, talks about how Russia was in the 80s stealing all of our chip technology, and how they were able to copy a lot of it, but they weren't able to recreate it to the same standard because it is such a specific and exacting process. Chemicals need to be preheated to a certain degree, held at a certain degree and then cooled at certain temperatures and let down temperatures to make sure that they form all of their bonds correctly. Just because you know that a cake takes eggs and flour does not mean you can make a cake. You can overdo it on one of the two ingredients or however many other ingredients, let alone if you don't know how long to cook it. But Russia was pretty good at copying, but the failure rate was significantly higher than those of what we were creating here in the United States. But then in comes cultural abilities, cultural norms, cultural standards on how businesses are run and how employees work at businesses. We look easily to the Germans and we have a stereotypical idea of them and their machining processes and how we sit there and we know that Mercedes and BMWs are exact machines measured down to the millimeter. They got little fancy protractors all over the places to make sure everything's exactly perfect. But the Germans had too much advanced power, too much value add, too much skill to make chips cheap and affordable. And that's the name of the game of chip processing, creating microprocessors and chips, integrated circuits, is volume pricing. Because the more you can fit onto one giant board and then cut it up into little tiny bits to send all over the place, the more money you can make. But they said chips aren't like cars where you can take a piece and then you send it across a body of water or just across the street. They're very specific. If you ever opened up a computer or known about opening up a computer, you know you're not supposed to rub your socks on the carpet. A little bit of static electricity can fry your multi-$100, multi-$1,000 computer. Supposed to ground yourself out, work in a clean room. And especially when creating chips, it needs to be a clean area. And so the cost of labor for when Eastern Asia was coming into the global market, into the global ecosystem, there were a lot of farmers and they needed cheap labor. They wanted out of the farms. They wanted into the cities. So they took factory jobs into making transistor circuits. And due to Japan and Korea's ability to hold the company as their primary believer, that's not correct. I don't want to use worship because that's wrong. They're not worshiping the company, but they hold a high regard, very high regard for the person that's employing them, the business that's employing them. Something that's not seen too much here in America, at least according to what's told on all of the local broadcasts. But they were able to condense and consolidate all of the processing of these chips into single buildings, smaller, much smaller footprints, again, than even just crossing the street to bring a board from one spot to the next for the next process. And just like we had DARPA, an arm of the government, arm of the Pentagon, helping fund Silicon Valley in their quest to create the integrated circuit, Taiwan's government was helping Taiwanese people build their business up, making sure that they were the powerhouse of the integrated circuit market. The more money you have to throw at these things, the more you can withstand the ups and downs of the market, and the bigger fabrications, bigger fabs you could build. Again, volumetric pricing to go out there and print everything. And there's still a lot of chips that are made in China as well. They're not built to the same standard. They're a little bit tougher on the quality. That's not hating on China, but that's just the factories that are built. The quality of things that are able to be had and understood. And I think it's just crazy that a little bit more than 130 years, we've gone from two upright pianos, not grand pianos, tabulating just a handful of things to something that fits in our pocket that can do so much more. And I'm no expert on chips and integrated circuits, fascinated by the business prospects of it all, questioning how far we can still take it because we've gone from, again, printing with projectors to then using lasers to engrave, and now we're zapping things at the atomic level. making things just atoms wide. And supposedly Moore's Law is no longer applicable, but that's not to say that we won't keep trying to squeeze as much processing power out of everything comparative to where we were and where we're going. And so we go on, looking to create our own integrated circuit of communication, process all of these details that have been coming along, or at least trying to get that spark of ingenuity to see if we can't randomly access some memory down the line, just to advance the conversation just a little bit, or maybe expand our own education. But I've been Billy Bones, B-I-L-L-Y-B-O-N, the number 3-S. You find me on Twitter, at Billy Bones. You find me on Mastodon, the Fediverse, at Billy Bones, at noagendasocial.com. I've also got a website, billybones.com. Go there for show notes. Got quite a few today. It's kind of like, view it as a YouTube playlist without the playlist feature. A lot of learning about transistors and chips and processors. And really cool stuff in there with the tubes as well. And this is a value for value podcast. If you found value out of this podcast, be it the single episode or the entire catalog, fantastic. I'm glad you did. The first thing that I ask that you do is you give this show a share. Maybe someone else finds a talking point, finds a rabbit hole worth chasing. But if you found that this show was worth a monetary value, be that US dollars or Satoshis, fantastic. I take both of those. And today I have two executive producers. Today, Miss Lady Get Over It sending in her $10 monthly donation. Thank you very much for that. And Fletcher sending in 4227 sats saying boost. Thank you, sir. Thank you, both of you, for keeping these lights on. And thank you, everybody else out there who's listening. I love you guys, and I'll talk to you next week.